like to thank TechServe today for sponsoring my show. Hi, and welcome to Why We Cook. This is Erica Wides. I'm a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, and you're listening today to the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting from Roberta's Pizzeria in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. Today, I want to talk about salt. If you listen to my last show was kind of an introduction to why we cook, and it was all about fire and how humans acquired fire and how it led us to create cooking or, you know, learn how to cook, and how that ultimately led to us becoming the top of the food chain, having big brains. And along with learning how to cook and capturing fire that way, you know, we also realized that we had to attain food sources that we normally would have just, you know, eaten raw, tracked down and eaten raw meat, things like that. So I thought, you know, along with harnessing fire, the other really singularly most important element in our food, other than cooking it, is salt. Without salt, we can't survive. Human history is based on the quest for salt. The evolution of cuisine is really about finding salt. So that's what we're going to talk about today. It's really the most important number one ingredient in the kitchen and in the history of food and in the history of cuisine. So when we talk about salt, what we're talking about is sodium chloride. There are a lot of different types of salts, but sodium chloride is table salt. That's what we eat. And it's what we think of when we think salty. When we think what salt in food, what is salty, that's what we're tasting, sodium chloride. And just to give you a little Earth history refresher course, the Earth is completely teeming with it. The planet is full of natural salt. It's in the sea, of course, dissolved. It's in massive underground deposits. It trickles up out of brine springs coming out of the ground. And, you know, when millions of years ago, when the oceans retreated, after, you know, we were a water-covered planet, the oceans retreated, and massive salt deposits were left all over the planet, which are now there underground and trickling up. And everywhere there are mountains of salt. And salt is the only rock eaten by humans. It's the only actual rock that we grind up and we eat. We don't eat any other ones. And it's completely essential for human physical existence. Without it, you die. If you have no salt at all in your diet, basically your heart stops working. You have no muscle function, and that's the end. So it's pretty crucial there. And so because of that, it's become one of the most sought-after commodities in human history. Wars have been fought over it. People have amassed empires and wealth based on it. So today it's all about salt. It's not something you normally think about as so important, but it's really important. So as a perfect tie-in with talking about salt, I wanted to also have someone on today who specializes in the process of basically applying salt to meat. And when you put salt and meat together and you add in some nice, cool, dry air, what you get is salumi, charcuterie, prosciutto, salami, things like that. So my guest today is Alexis Picciotta, who is, did I say it right?
Yes, you did.
Okay, good. Who
I'm impressed.
Used to be my student at ICE and is one of my favorite people. And she is now chef de cuisine at Salumeria Rossi on the Upper West Side. So hi, Alexis.
How are you doing?
Thank you very much. So Why We Cook. So I'm sure you can really relate to all of this. Talking about salt, I'm sure you spend your days rubbing salt all over pigs.
Yes, yeah. Massaging.
Alexis has worked in a lot of great restaurants in New York and sort of worked her way around the salumi world and really knows a lot. She's a great resource and is really an amazing cook, an amazing person, has great energy, was one of my favorite students. So we're going to talk a lot to her toward the end of the show, but she'll be here the whole time and she'll be piping in with anything. Feel free to join the conversation today. So we're going to take a very short break. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the history of salt and how it affected us as humans and where it brought us to. And then we'll talk a little bit about technique, about using it in cooking and how it affects various proteins, how it affects different foods. And then we'll talk some more with Alexis. So we'll be back very soon. to give a big thank you today to TechServe for sponsoring the show. Welcome back to Why We Cook. I'm Erica Wides, and we are broadcasting today on the Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick. And joining me is Alexis Pisciotta, the chef de cuisine at Salumeria Rossi in Manhattan. So we're talking about salt today, and salt, it's a fascinating thing because salt really does a lot of different things. First of all, it preserves our food, which we'll talk about later, which, of course, is important because we didn't have refrigeration until about 100 years ago, so we had to keep our food from rotting. It protects against decay. The ancient Egyptians used it to mummify people, and it basically makes things last forever. And it also sustains life. Seawater sustains life. The human body's filled with salt. You're filled with saline, basically. So it's a pretty fascinating substance. It's also loaded with religious symbolism. Loyalty and friendships have been sealed with salt throughout history. In Judaism and in Islam, it seals immutable bargains. If they're sealed with salt, it's permanent. Also, in early Judaism and Islam, it protected infants from the evil eye. Infants were sprinkled with salt to protect them from the evil eye. And in early Christianity, infants were submerged in seawater to protect them. And they think that that's the ritual that really predated baptism. When somebody moves into a new home in Judaism, you bring salt and bread to their house. And my mom actually did that the first time I had my own apartment. She brought me salt and bread. And in the Middle Ages, farmers learned to protect their grain from ergot fungus. Ergot is this fungus that makes people go crazy. It's what they think caused the Salem witch trials, the Salem witch craze. The ergot's killed by first soaking your grain in brine and then drying it. So people figured this out a pretty long time ago. In traditional Japanese theater, they sprinkle salt on the stage to protect the actors from evil spirits. And like I said before, Egyptians used it, too, to mummify their dead because they last forever, basically, once they're salted. So the history of food is really the history of a quest for salt because, as I said, we can't survive without it. But culturally also and in religious history, it plays a huge role. So way, way back when humans were hunters and gatherers out on the savannas of Africa, the hunters got their salt from the meat that they ate because animals instinctively know to seek out salt. They get it from their food. They know where to find it. They look for salt licks. So if you were a meat eater, you got your meat from salt. But gatherers and agricultural tribes actually needed the salt. They didn't know it sort of consciously, but they knew because they weren't getting it from their meat that they needed it. So they would have to provide it for their cultivated animals, so their domesticated animals. They would actually have to feed them salt. Wild carnivores like humans get it from meat by hunting other carnivores, but herbivores, grazing animals, have to forage for it. So early hunters realized that if they followed animals who were walking to find salt, they could not only find animals to hunt, but they could also then take the salt from the salt lick. And actually, there's a theory that the city of Buffalo, New York, upstate, actually came into being that way because Buffalo sits over a huge salt deposit. There was an ancient sea up there that retreated and left the Great Lakes behind. And the wild bison, the wild buffalo, used to create paths in the brush, in the prairie, to get to that salt lick. And the early Native Americans knew if they followed those paths to the salt lick, then they would find the buffalo there and they would find the salt. And those paths led to trails. And then the Europeans came and followed those trails and established encampments there and settlements. And lo and behold, city of Buffalo.
Well, let me ask you a question. When you say salt lick, does that actually mean a deposit chunk of salt that the animals lick?
Yeah, it's salt that was left behind from an ancient sea. Mm-hmm. And when the water evaporated out, the salt just crystallized, mineralized there. And it becomes exposed. It's outcroppings, like the soil washes away over thousands of years. And it just sticks out. Yeah, and the animals find it because they know that they need it. You know, did you ever have like a little pet like guinea pig and you had to put a little salt block in the cage?
No, never had a guinea pig.
I did. And we had to put this little salt wheel in there for it to lick. And now I understand why. So when humans began domesticating animals, we had to provide them with salt because we weren't allowing them out to lick it on their own and to find it. So we had to provide it for them. And the first animals that were domesticated by humans were sheep and goats and something called the auroch, which is the descendant of today's cattle, and they all needed salt. A cow needs 10 times the amount of salt as a human. It's pretty crazy. So yeah. we had to provide it for them. Okay, so there's the history. So procuring of salt became a real necessity of settled agrarian life. And when people really kind of standardized agriculture, they had to figure out a way to get it. And it became a commodity. It became one of the first international commodities of trade. And its production became one of the first industries. The Roman Empire was built on salt, on the quest for salt and on mining of salt. And it occurs, like I said, everywhere on Earth. But before techniques of modern geology, it was actually really hard to get. People figured out how to evaporate it from seawater or how to get tap it from brine springs. But to actually excavate underground was much trickier before geology and mining techniques. So it was much more precious. And it was really the first widely traded commodity. And so for thousands of years, salt really equaled wealth. Wealth in the form of we control the salt, we control the access to it, and you don't. So we're going to control you that way. So whoever controlled the production of salt controlled the flow of wealth and really held the power, like the ancient Romans. And early governments used it to as a tax. They would tax the salt to fund wars, and they would pay their soldiers and their workers in it, and that's where the word salary comes from, from there. So there you go. Okay, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little more about technique, and we'll talk some more with Lexis, and we'll talk some more about salt. So we'll be back in a few minutes. So big thanks to TechServe today for sponsoring the show. Welcome back to Why We Cook. I'm Erica Wides, and joining me is Alexis Pisciotta from Salou Maria Rossi. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network today, broadcasting from Roberta's Pizzeria. So along, of course, with being necessary for animal agriculture, there are all sorts of food-based uses for salt. And the really number one, most important one is curing and preserving food, because we have only had refrigeration for about 100 years now. So basically since the beginning of time, since people started eating, they realized that if they killed a big animal and couldn't eat it all in one sitting, they had to preserve it somehow. So people really figured out early on that if they applied salt to it, it would dry it out. So that's where the whole tradition of salumi that Alexis is so good at comes from. You guys must go through a lot of salt every week.
Yeah, right.
Curing all of that meat.
Actually, yeah. Right now we are not curing meat at the Salou Maria.
Oh, okay.
But it's too difficult with the health department.
The health, right.
And we don't want to, you know, create a problem there. The facility's small. It's not really set up for that. But we did at Lupa and Il Buco.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you go through a lot of salt.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure. Yeah. So before we get to meat, what I want to actually talk about is vegetables, fermentation. If a vegetable is allowed to just naturally ferment, to rot, basically as it decays, sugars start to break down and produce lactic acid, which is a great preservative in a vegetable. But if left sort of unchecked, the vegetable just rots. So people realize very early on that if they added salt to that process, the salt would slow down that lactic acid fermentation. And it would create a pickled product, a salted cured vegetable. So it was the Chinese really early on began pickling cabbage and pickling fish and turning their fresh produce into cured produce. The same applies to cheese making. Early humans who started to domesticate milk-producing animals realized quickly that the milk would spoil. So they figured out, first of all, how to curdle it using rennet, which is an enzyme from a calf's stomach. But if it was just curdled and then left, various molds and yeasts would get in it too quickly, and it would start to rot. And they realized that if they added salt to that, it slows down the process, the preservation process. So it really kind of across the spectrum was applied to vegetables, to fish, to dairy products, to meats, as a way of slowing down the natural fermentation process, because only the hardiest bacteria survive when you apply the salt to the food. And that way you slow down the process enough so that the bad bugs basically get killed off by the salt. I was teaching a class the other day and I was seasoning some meat and, you know, I was touching the raw meat and then I was putting my hand in the salt and sprinkling salt. And one of the people in the class kind of freaked out and she said, "Oh, you're putting all that bacteria into the salt." And I said, "Don't worry about it. Nothing lives in there. It's safe." But
it's outnumbered.
It's totally outnumbered. In bread baking, salt retards yeast. It slows down the growth of yeast so that breads don't proof too quickly and then turn into alcohol, basically. And that's how alcohol is. And, you know, what salt does other than killing bacteria is it removes moisture from food to allow them to be dried and preserved. And the invention of salt cod, bacala, salt cod, was one of the most important developments in food history because the invention of that enabled sailors to go out to sea for years and years at a time. Because once you're way out at sea in the depths of the ocean, there's actually very little fish to be caught. Fish like to hug the continental shelf. So sailors couldn't go out to sea for 2 years and fish off the side of the boat and survive. So they actually had to bring salt cod with them. And it was the Basque people in Spain and in France who really perfected that technique for salting cod. And they were great sailors and great shipbuilders. And they were really the ones who started the whole transoceanic trade and were the first ones to really voyage to the New World because they were able to use that salt cod. And salt cod really became one of the first food commodities because it allowed the trade between Europe and North America, which then really funded the slave trade. It was salt cod that led to enough back and forth travel and funding that people could then get involved in the slave trade. Mark Kurlansky, who's a really, really great author, wrote a couple of books all about that. One's called Salt, obviously, and I got a lot of my facts from him. One's called Cod, and one's called The Basque History of the World, and they're all about the interconnection between salt and cod and human trafficking and trade, and it's all pretty interesting. Okay, so we're going to take another short break, and when we get back, we'll talk some more about salt, and I keep saying we're going to talk to Alexis, and we really are this time. So we'll be back in a few seconds. You're listening to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. Thank TechServe today for sponsoring my show. Welcome back to Why We Cook. I'm Erica Wides, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick. So I was just talking in the last segment about how salt was applied to food to enable it to be preserved in the pre-refrigeration era. And we talked a little bit about the Basque and the salt cod. But it was the early Celtic people in Northern Europe who really perfected the mining of salt. They really figured out how to actually tunnel into the mountains and get the salt out. And they figured out that if they took that salt and they rubbed it on the legs of wild boar, they would get these amazing cured hams. And when the Romans expanded north into Northern Europe and began conquering and encountered the ancient Celts, they brought pigs with them. The Romans brought pigs into Northern Europe, and the Romans saw them doing this and said, "Oh, we can do this with our pigs. Let's put salt on our pigs, our domesticated pigs, and there you have it. That's where prosciutto and all of those great things came. And the Romans, like I mentioned earlier, built their empire on salt. The Romans were also great miners and excavators of salt. And down in the Mediterranean, they controlled the salt works, big evaporation systems for extracting sea salt. And they used that salt to fund the empire. Of course, they were a slave-based economy, so it allowed them to have incredible wealth and incredible profits because they weren't actually paying anybody to do it. If you visit Rome today, there's a very large road that leads out of Rome, and it's called the Via Salaria, and that was the salt road. That was what the Romans used to transport the salt in and out of Rome from all over southern Europe, basically. And the use of salt to cure meats really flourished in southern and central Europe after that. The techniques and recipes for salted and spiced and dried pork became the foundation for that huge array of salumi and charcuterie and the German techniques that we love so much today. And now we can talk to Alexis about that. I've gotten to that point in history. So she, like I said, was my student at ICE many years ago and has since moved on to great things. So do you want to give us a little bit of a timeline of your career since you left ICE?
Okay. I started out as an intern at Lupa. What drew me to Lupa was the salumi program. I knew they were doing charcuterie there, and it was really good charcuterie. And so I showed up there and basically wouldn't leave until they gave me an internship. And they were kind of like, all right, this girl's not going away. Let's let her intern here. So that's where I started. And got to assist the sous chef in a lot of the salumi making, and then worked there and worked through the ranks until I became sous chef and took over the salumi program, which mm-hmm. was so exciting.
Yeah.
And we made mostly ground salumi, like mm-hmm. things like finocchiona and
right.
soppressata and cacciatorini. And we did do some whole cuts as well,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't do so many prosciutti because
yeah.
it's big.
It's storage,
you know, and
right.
it requires a lot of space.
Where are you gonna hang them?
Exactly.
Right.
And the prosciutti also need a more particular environment mm-hmm. than the ground salumi as well.
Right. You need the cool, dry mountain air blowing over it.
Exactly.
In the hills of Umbria.
Exactly. And what's funny is we went to Parma to see the prosciutti get made.
Oh, wow.
And they simulate the four seasons when they do it.
Oh, how cool.
So the animal is always slaughtered in the fall,
mm-hmm.
and then that is what the environment is created as, and then when it goes to, you know, through the seasons, then it becomes winter. They move it into another area where
That's
it simulates
great.
Winter, and then it goes into spring.
Wow. And they change the humidity levels.
Everything,
yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
Wow,
it's pretty interesting.
Really cool.
Yeah. So after I left Lupa, I went to Il Buco, who everybody knows the horrible story about the bleach getting poured on all the meats at Il Buco.
Well, everybody that we know, but not everybody who's listening.
All
so
right, all
run
right.
over that really quick.
I'll run over that. Il Buco was doing meat curing as well, and they were doing a product that was just salt, you know? There wasn't any starter culture in it, and it was the way that the Italians came over and taught them how to do it. And the health department, who basically for a long time didn't really know how to handle the salami making because there wasn't
they had
a
no
real...
frame of reference
they had
for
no
it.
Frame of
right.
reference for it. No one was getting sick from it, but they just didn't know what to do with it. All they knew is that it wasn't being held at the right temperature. So, I mean, even with Lupa, every time the health department came, we were ready to be shut down. We had our HACCP plans and all of our paperwork, but we knew that at any time it could happen.
Yeah.
So it did at Il Buco, and they came in and poured bleach over the whole supply. And even though they did have laboratory tests run on the meat showing it
mm-hmm.
was safe,
they still
it's not according to their standards
oh,
or
gosh.
Something that they can understand. So
right.
That whole thing got shut down and thrown away.
Wow. Wow.
So now the only things that they do make there are lardo and coppa di testa, which
mm-hmm.
is head cheese. So
mm-hmm.
head cheese and lardo, which is essentially just
cured fat.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just packed in salt.
Wow.
That's it.
We have to take a short break, but we're going to come back and talk some more about that. We'll be back very soon on Why We Cook.
We'll be right back.
TechServe again today for sponsoring my show. Welcome back to Why We Cook. We were just talking to Alexis about the tragedy that befell all the Salumi program when she was working at Il Buco. So the health department comes in, they pour bleach over all your product. You have to throw it all out, start from zero. And that's like months and months and months of meat that you've been curing. So what happened? They shut down the program?
The program was shut down. I actually didn't work there when it got shut down, nor did I work at Lupa when theirs got shut down. So I feel a little fortunate that I wasn't there to cry and witness it.
See all your work thrown out. Yeah.
But yeah, then that's it. And now people have been submitting in plans, and they're starting to approve programs. Mm-hmm. Basically, you need to have a very detailed account of the temperatures mm-hmm. of everything, which is pretty interesting because the temperature is probably the least of the important things when it comes to the meat. I would think that they would want you to check the pH and the acidity, right? And instead, they want a very detailed account of the temperatures of the meat from like the second it comes in the door and how long it's been held at that temperature, and you know, which you also then have to get registered with them. So it's evolving, you know. For mm-hmm. a long time, they didn't really know how to treat it.
Right.
And so it was a crapshoot as to when you were going to get the right person who was going to shut you down.
Yeah, right. I mean, I remember when I was a sous chef and they would come in with their little thermometers, and that was sort of their only set of parameters. They wanted to know the temperature of everything.
Exactly.
We had stock cooling on the floor that they weren't happy about, and they, same thing, took a gallon of bleach and dumped it in the stock, and I had just spent, you know, 8 hours cooking that stock. And then you're screwed because your service is starting. And yeah. So if you submit a program now, they're allowing it to happen. If you are really like a HACCP kind of
a
program.
A HACCP plan. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You submit a HACCP plan, it becomes approved, and then they're allowing it to happen. I'm not entirely positive as to what they're looking for now at the moment. But I'm very interested in finding out what it is. Mm-hmm. What I do know is that the temperature is the crucial thing mm-hmm. there. The temperature and the humidity.
I mean, it's so ridiculous. You know, it, like so many things in the food world, these are techniques that people have been using
for
thousands
years, exactly.
and thousands of years.
Exactly.
And
no one's getting sick.
And no one's getting sick. And the health department just does, it's like they don't understand that. You know, it's like anything. It's like raw milk cheeses, like all of the stuff that for millennia humans have been surviving mm-hmm. on. And, you know, it's like we're such victims of our own rules and our own
exactly.
laws. We get so narrowly
And the
defined.
USDA doesn't even have as much of a problem as the New York Health Department. Mm. They, you know, it's a big city and there's a lot of things to control and they're trying to keep it safe for everybody at, you know, the detriment of these artisanal products and, you know, things that they don't know enough about.
And it's so frustrating because we're just sort of on the brink of this really major artisanal revolution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, you know, what's so amazing about what's going on in food right now is there are so many people producing interesting things and reviving techniques that are thousands of years old.
And most of the product, I mean, anyone that's doing charcuterie is getting in a whole animal, knows exactly where it came from, how it was raised, what it was eating, you know, uses the entire animal. The quality of the meat is always excellent. If you're doing charcuterie, you're doing it, you know?
Yeah.
So it's such a low risk of getting people sick.
You're not bringing in the industrial pork from Smithfield.
And you can tell if a product is off. It's fairly easy to tell. I mean, the smell of it will just tell you the color of the molds on it, you know?
Right.
It's the texture of it.
Yeah, you
so,
just know.
So, I mean, it's not...
Right.
It's not a...
Yeah, it's like when you're pickling.
Dangerous.
You know right away if... Well, I mean, if there's botulism involved, you never know until it's too late. But but if you're pickling, you know, if your product comes out too soft, if there's an off smell. Like at ICE, once in a while, we used to make our own sauerkraut as part of the curriculum. And you knew if it smelled like sauerkraut, if it was good.
Right.
And if there was mold on top and it smelled funny, it was bad. And we were smart
Don't eat
enough
it.
To throw that out. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and getting off of meat a little bit, I mean, that's also really what's fascinating about salting is you can take something like cabbage and shred it up and mix it with salt and let it sit, and all the little natural yeasts and bacteria on the cabbage just go crazy and they turn it into vinegar, they turn it into acetic acid. But having salt in there prevents all the bad guys from getting it moldy and making it bad. And that's what's so brilliant about this is, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago people said, huh, let's put salt on this and see what happens.
And it tastes good.
And it tastes really good. I know. And it's real food. You know, and people say, oh, well, all that salt, my blood pressure, da, da, da. But that's not the salt that's causing the problem. It's the salt in the canned soup and the frozen dinners and the fast food and all that. Right. And, you know, you come into a place like Rossi where you're working and, you know, you're going to order the stuff and get a couple of little slices of it. And it's enough because it's so delicious and so succulent. And you're not sitting down and eating 8 or 10 ounces of this cured. Well, I would.
I do every day.
I know. And when I came in, you sent me so much great stuff. It was like cured meat festival. But, you know, in general. And it also comes, it's from an era when people didn't eat as much meat, when meat was more precious. And you would cure it and you would make it last for the winter. So you would slice off tiny little pieces and eat it sparingly. And that's what's so beautiful about it is that, you know, if you were a peasant farmer in Italy and you raised that one pig for food for the year and you put, you know, your time and your resources into it, then you would slaughter that pig and every single part of it would become useful. And, you know, but the Norcino, the guys from Umbria, the traditional butchers, right? I love that these were these itinerant pig butchers and they would travel around Umbria, you know, and help people slaughter their pigs and process it. And then
it's romantic.
It's so romantic. And then take their pay in salumi, you know, like give them a couple of, you know, finocchiona and, you know, and a leg. And then they would go on to the next farm. And that's such a beautiful concept. And that one pig put away, cured, salted, would last that family for a year. In The Grapes of Wrath, there's a great scene where the Joads are getting ready to pack it up and go out to California because, you know, they're in Oklahoma and the Dust Bowl hits and the Depression. And there's this great description of how they had this pig and they said, well, we can't leave the pig behind. The pig's too valuable. So they killed the pig and they salted it down and they packed it into barrels and they took it with them. And I love that. I mean, that wasn't that long ago in this country that people had to do that.
And it wasn't technical either.
It wasn't.
It's simple.
They just smeared salt all over it. I know, it's really, it's like a really great descriptive passage in the book. It really affected me because I thought, God, that was only, what, 70 years ago. I mean, people, you know, had to do that. It was a survival thing. So it's all really fascinating. So at Rossi now, you guys, so you said you don't do that much because it's a space issue really for you and a technical issue.
Yes.
And so you import a lot of stuff
from Italy?
We source,
yes. Mm-hmm. We import from Italy and from the States. Mm-hmm. We source out which products from different makers in the United States that we like.
Right. Isn't there a company in Iowa that makes prosciutto?
Yes,
now?
There's a company. There's a lot of, there are a company in New Jersey. There is Berkeley, California. Mm-hmm. San Francisco, a lot of people are sprouting up.
Yeah.
And then there's always the Arthur Avenue.
Right, your hometown, the Bronx.
Bronx people who've been doing it forever, too. I'm not quite sure how they get around the regulations.
Well, you know, they have special connections up there in the Bronx.
We source out between the States and Italy because it's not entirely legal to bring all of the things in from Italy yet, which it's working to get past.
Right. I remember a few years ago when Bresaola finally made the cut.
Exactly.
Which is air-dried beef. We haven't even talked about other meats other than
pork. Right.
Right. Bresaola just a few years ago. And real prosciutto hasn't been
here
for that long.
Yeah. Just like how the Spanish Iberico was just passed to come in, you know, the USDA needs to test it and look at their methods. And actually, there is a different standard. Like prosciutto makers in Italy need to adhere to slightly different standards to import to the States. So they have separate prosciutti that they make specially for us.
For import.
Yes, for import, which it's still an excellent quality. There are slight differences, but... they're working on passing more things to come into the States right now, which
that's
is good.
Great.
We're working on it. We're getting there.
Right. There's actually a Chinese version of salt cured ham. It's sort of like a Smithfield ham, and it's not allowed to be imported. And it's at ICE in the curriculum, we have a recipe for a hot and sour soup, and we use either prosciutto or Smithfield ham in it. And the students are always like, why are we putting prosciutto in this soup? Well, because we can't get the Chinese version. It's not allowed. You know, we can't get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like prosciutto Toscano, not allowed in the States yet.
Oh, really?
Not allowed in the States yet. It's made in Tuscany. It's, you know, the main difference that you can see from your eyes is that it's rubbed with black pepper.
Oh, nice.
But not allowed in the States yet.
Right.
So we're working on it.
Yeah. I mean, what's also so beautiful about this stuff is, you know, I love to really emphasize this when I teach is that, you know, along with you being what you, you know, you are what you eat. With the animals too, it's so important what the animals are fed. And what's so amazing with prosciutto is that you can really taste the difference if you eat the prosciutto di Parma. Those pigs are finished on the, you know, Parmesan cheese byproducts, and the prosciutto di San Daniele, those guys eat chestnuts, right? And then the Bellotta pigs in Spain, they eat the acorns.
They eat acorns, yeah.
And you can really taste it, you know. I mean, you really are what you eat, you know. So I always say that when I teach, you know, if you're eating garbage, that's what you're going to taste like garbage. So it's pretty amazing. So where, what's your sort of future? What's going to happen? You're working at Salù Maria Rossi. Are you guys going to expand? I mean, business seems really...
Yeah, the plan is for us to open up more stores. Mm-hmm. This is a model.
Yeah.
So it's small, but the ones in the future shouldn't be. I mean, that's the plan. Mm-hmm. Perhaps there'll be some curing in the future.
Excellent.
There's some good stuff going on in the country right now. There are some people who are doing beautiful products and are just about to break out and get them certified and everything. So it's exciting.
That's great. And is the retail side of it holding steady even in the bad economy? Are people still buying?
Actually, yes. It's surprisingly thriving because it's looked on as a value, first of all. I mean, it's not incredibly expensive. People are more receptive to buying things and taking them home to eat as opposed to sitting in a full-service restaurant. So, and it's, I think it's also got some kind of romantic quality to it about, you know, taking home a dry salami and a baguette or a bottle of wine and eating. So it's doing well. People are really interested too, asking a lot of questions and it's good.
It's great. I mean, I feel like Americans are really waking up and discovering food. It's heartening. I think it's very, it gives
necessary
me some optimism.
Too.
Yeah. That we're sort of rediscovering, you know, techniques that were used here too not that long ago and were lost in industrialization, and I think there's a real throwing off of that now, and people are coming back to that, which is great. I mean, we haven't even talked about, you know, other things like beef or duck, things like duck confit, and, you know, in other regions of Europe how all that was done, and, you know, and what you can do with salt for curing fish and how it's used in sushi. I mean, there's so much. So I think I'll probably
brines,
right, and rubs and all the stuff.
Part two.
I'm going to have to do a part two on salt. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your salumi story with us. And we'll have you back definitely another time. And so I think we're going to have to do a part two on salt because I have a lot more to talk about. And I think it's a fascinating topic. I don't know if other people really think it is, but I think if you're interested in food, it's one of the most important primal elements
and
that
misunderstood
there is. And misunderstood, absolutely. I know it makes me crazy when, you know, my mom now has high blood pressure and she's always like, oh, I can't eat the salt. I'm like, you have to reevaluate it.
Right.
You have to think about what you're actually eating. You know, like we were saying, if something is so flavorful and complex and great, like a really good cured meat, you don't have to eat that much of it. You know, it's more of the European mode of eating. Eat a little bit of that and enjoy it. You don't have to supersize it.
Mm.
I'm very anti-supersize.
Yes.
Yeah, so, all right. Well, thanks so much for coming in. And you have been listening to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. And I'm Erica Wides. I'm a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education. And again, I want to thank TechServe for sponsoring my show today, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.